I wanted to give a little sense of what I got from when I turned away from reading your books. It was a real interesting experience for me. So I really, you know, being involved in High Frontiers and everything, I had to really think about what is the meaning of all this? Mm-hmm. What is all this about? And I read the book, and I had this... Did you ever see The Seven Faces of Dr. Lao? This mm-hmm. silly movie with Tony Randall where he's this, like, Chinese sage who comes to town, and everybody relates to him in their own strange way, but nobody gets it. And mm-hmm. and so they all sort of manifest their own faults and their own positive aspects through him. And I was really, like, seeing that in your book, LSD. It was like a novel in a way. LSD is like the mysterious stranger that comes to town, and then everybody goes and plays out their riffs. Mm-hmm. But there's the underlying thing, I guess, with, you know, whatever that is, whether it's a spiritual thing, you know, it has to be referred to as the perfection that's underneath everything. Mm-hmm. Nagual or the goddess, or however you want to relate to it. In a sense, is perhaps too high for the human beings, or not within the grasp of human personality and politics, or at least that's... And so I, for a while, I was kind of, well, I read this book, and of all the characters in the book, I thought LSD came off better than anybody else, except maybe Aldous Huxley and Albert Hoffman.
Well, Hubbard is kind of interesting.
I don't know. I was wondering, so I guess what that brings around is, like, what did you get out of all this, like, philosophically? What
in terms of how it relates to the mystical stuff?
Yeah, what did it show you, just in terms of, you know, on an existential level about the nature of reality and also about human beings and that sort of thing?
Well, it shows that human beings have a fantastic capacity for self-deception, on the one hand. But I'm more to the point what you were saying about the mystical implications of the LSD experience. You know, I wouldn't want people to read the book and come off saying, oh, gee, you know, the CIA got it wrong thinking it's an anxiety-producing drug, and hippies got it wrong thinking it was a sacrament. And, I wouldn't come away from it thinking that, you know, the perception of the infinite is sort of beyond the grasp or not the business of people in general. I would say just the opposite, that its profound mystical implications seem to be that while the drug in and of itself is not, I wouldn't say it is per se a sacrament, its ability to induce mystical experiences, while that's not something inherent in the drug, it really shows that it's, you know, inherent in ourselves, and that if it's an ecstatic drug, it's because we are capable of experiencing ecstasy, and if it's you know, an insightful drug, is that because we have insights waiting to be born, and if it's if it yields mystical perceptions, it's because we have that potential for a mystical perception. So that in anything, it reaffirms something very basic about human nature that's fundamental and cuts across all cultures at all times. And that should not be beyond the grasp of people, or should be considered too much, but on the other, it should be everybody's birthright to have those kinds of experiences and perceptions, which, you know, as we all know, doesn't require a drug necessarily, but it certainly makes it a lot easier or quicker in certain ways, although there are pitfalls that come along with that too, perhaps, that maybe people didn't acknowledge enough back in the 60s when these things first were being dumped appearing in a large way in the culture. So, I guess, does that answer your questions?
Yeah. I would be more precise about what I came away from it with is that it's... When people come in and try to put their own stamp on it and use it either as a tool or a weapon, It seems like on two ends of the right wing, CIA, the army, and those guys using it as a weapon, and the left wing, they're using it as a weapon in terms of the Weather Underground, and some of the people who are more extreme, in a sense, saw it as a weapon.
But they had it in terms of it, they had a utilitarian perspective.
And in between, there are all these people thinking of it as a tool, from Leary, Huxley, and et cetera. So in that sense, it's hard to direct it as something that you can use outwardly. And you can use it for yourself, but it becomes, the moment you start moving it around and saying, this is what it's going to do for society, for other people, it becomes
more problematic.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I can fully understand how people like Leary and Ginsberg early on, they're having these incredible experiences. They're mistakenly attributing these experiences to the drug rather than to their own mind. Not that it has nothing to do with the drug, but assuming that this experience is something that the drug gave them, therefore the drug will give that experience to everybody else.
Sort of confusing the key with the lock.
Yeah, and once you're thinking along those lines, it's very understandable how then the clue becomes, or the key becomes, make this available to everybody, or as many people as possible, and then people will, by definition, automatically share certain common perceptions that happen to be interesting, insightful, helpful, positive perceptions. So therefore, things can only get better.
Yeah.
So I can understand how people would get into that number, particularly when they have something like television and the mass media at their disposal. Not only do they have this incredible substance that seems to be guaranteed for producing a certain kind of positive experience, but they also have the media at their beck and call, where they can get the message across just like that. So it's this combination of these two unprecedented factors in human history, where for the first time ever, massive amounts, millions of doses of hallucinogen, a synthetic hallucinogen, whereas previously you had only naturally occurring hallucinogen, so you're not going to have millions of doses. And also for the first time, you have social movements interacting with this powerful new perceptual technology, television, in a way that was unprecedented in human history. So it's these two perceptual technologies that interacted and collided with social movements that created a situation that was really interesting and full of promise in ways that were such that people didn't realize the pitfalls there as well. And maybe the next go-round will, you know, they don't have to make the same mistakes.
I'm curious a little bit about your background in terms of when you came into this, were you an activist?
Was it research or?
Well, in terms of were you an activist in the New Left? Involved in the underground press?
I was pretty young in the 60s. I was 16 in 1970.
What made you want to begin researching this particular subject?
Well, I had participated somewhat, you know, as an activist, quote-unquote, at the tail end of the 60s. And I, you know, identified strongly with both the political and the cultural upheavals and the rebellions there. And, you know, to the extent that one can participate in those things when you're 14 years old, I mean, certainly in a limited way, but nevertheless, I was certainly caught up in that to the degree that one could be at that age. And
how old?
I was 14 then. So I'm 32 now.
I'm 33.
So I had an inherent interest in terms of that, this being my background, my social setting or roots. And so part of it was trying to understand something about me and something about the culture, which is going to, you know, shed light on something about me. As, you know, historically and personally, I mean, I had a personal interest in understanding this. But in terms of the CIA stuff, that grows from literary and journalistic interests.
Did that come up after the church committee and the public testimony? Or?
Came actually a little before. I was interested in the Kennedy assassination.
Uh-huh. And, so you were researching the Lee Harvey Oswald aspect on that?
Yeah, with some friends in Washington, we were working with a group called Assassination Information Bureau. And it was a legitimate, albeit poorly funded, grassroots sort of
hand-to-mouth. I've heard of it, right?
But we did some good work there, despite all odds. And while we were down in Washington, it was maybe sometimes half dozen, sometimes 10 people there. Everyone got into other areas that seemed in some ways related to the questions of Kennedy and Kinkelly, and I got into this drug testing and mind control documents, initially to see if it would shed any light on the whole assassination question or, say, mafia plots against Castro or anything like that, which there are connections there.
Bumped into a lot of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, so that was the first impetus, but day one, as soon as I started looking at documents, that stuff fell away, and I got much more interested in understanding what was happening with the CIA and the drugs. And very early on in this research, I kind of postulated posed the question of what is the relationship between the subterranean CIA business and the counterculture 60 stuff, having a hunch that there is somehow a relationship there, and it would be important to study it, and that perhaps by studying it, it would shed some light on the way things happened in the 60s, not thinking that there was any grand conspiracy and the CIA was manipulating things, but just thinking that there was some important relationship between these two spheres.
This was discussed a lot last night, that you sort of say you don't want people to come away feeling that, the CIA created the whole psychedelic culture in the 60s.
Sure.
And
that's a terrible oversimplification.
Yeah. So you go more along with the idea that the cat got out of the bag unintentionally.
Yeah, in a way.
And they naturally wanted to see what was happening, and, you know, basically their job to keep informed about what's going on so that they can manipulate the situation.
In some ways, the CIA was almost like an unwitting midwife to the birth of the acid generation.
Yeah.
And that there are these...
Neary sort of talks about it.
Neary initially was sort of saying the CIA started everything, and that was a touch of Leary-esque hyperbole. But I think the picture I have, you have certain streams or tributaries that are feeding into what's going to be the river of, I should say, the roaring river of the 60s situation, the 60s upheavals. And one of those streams is the CIA and Army experiments. And that overlaps with the scientific community, more in terms of the psychotomimetic school. There's that relationship. But then the research community, the scientific community, the legitimate above-ground stuff, there's also, there's two schools happening there. It's not only the psychotomimetic madness mimicking school, but the psychedelic school. And that overlaps with literary circles, people like Huxley and so forth, and the Beats to some degree also. The Beats are almost more like a third street level. So really, the CIA Army, the scientists and psychiatrists, the Beats and the literary folks. And it's a commingling of all these divergent streams that are going to set the stage for what happens. Granted that there are certain obvious factors, sociological factors, economic factors that make it a very ripe, fertile setting for the planting of that seed that's going to happen. I should probably ask you guys questions.
Well, it's a free conversation. Did you ever suspect as you were doing this, have you ever read the Illuminatus books by Robert Anton Wilson? Did you ever suspect the possibility of some secret society being behind all of this?
Manipulating both LSD and the CIA and the...
Perhaps having some occult or magical purposes that might have been involved with the CIA, with counterculture, with all that. Did you bump into anything or hear anything?
I did. No, I didn't include some of this in the book, but I'll tell you. First of all, I think that I've done research on secret societies in terms of the Catholic Church and the Knights of Malta. I've done a lot of research.
There's a lot of stuff on the Knights of Malta in Wilson's new book called The Widow's Son, which is the best thing he's written since the Illuminatus trilogy.
I'm sure he got that all from stuff I've written, because I broke the story a few years ago about the CIA and the Knights of Malta.
He might have even referred to it.
It's possible. I don't know. I'd be curious. But they're an old, very old order, going back to the Crusades. Freemasonry, all that. I mean, I'm interested in those things, and I think these secret societies do play a far greater role in history than most historians, Marxist historians, bourgeois historians, would acknowledge. But I'm interested in that stuff a lot. In terms of the LSD, there's a lot of interesting material I didn't put in the book. First of all, the Nazis were very into the occult. And there are rumors that Hitler had experimented with peyote. And I think that there's well, we know that the Nazis were experimenting with mescaline in Dachau, but I think also Hitler's inner circle that was very much involved with the occult. In fact, they had a whole occult bureau within the SS called the Annenerbe. They were interested in various, well, you know, the Tibetan stuff, that's what it's called. Right. You know, they're interested in pre-Christian, pre-Christian studies, pagan-oriented.
Yeah.
So, these people seem to be very open-minded when it came to, or more so, more receptive to notions of wealth and states and these type of things. The Nazis were really uptight about Freemasons. They tried to crack down on them.
They were aware of it.
Yeah. And they sensed that there was power there. Now, in the LSD story, see, Dulles was in Switzerland during the war.
Alan Dulles.
Yeah, Alan Dulles. And at one point, he is joined in Switzerland by Carl Jung, who had been in Germany up until, like, 1942 as an editor of one of the top, maybe the preeminent psychological journal or psychiatric journal. And that's at a time when Jung, instead of talking about the collective unconscious, starts talking about the racial unconscious, and Jewish archetypes are now different from other dark archetypes, and he started getting into some of that stuff. I mean, I think there's a sleazy side to Jung, although I think he's an amazing thinker. But there's a bit of a strange side to him that people might make light of. But he went and worked with Dulles, giving psychological assessments of some of the Nazi leaders, giving that information to the OSS. Now, there's reason to believe that Jung might have also experimented with peyote. He certainly was aware of these substances and had written about or referred to them in some context. I don't know if he had personal experience. There's some who claim that he has. I never was able to confirm that, but it's quite possible that Jung might have imparted to Dulles certain information about these kinds of chemicals, and it's under Dulles, of course, that the LSD stuff really happens in a big way in the CIA. I don't know if he had himself had any experience with it, but so I don't know.
Martin Lee?
Okay, hold on just a second.
Thanks. Continue on from you were talking about the Jung Dulles.
Yeah. Well, just that there was also Dulles' former assistant was Jung's secretary, a woman named Anne Bancroft. Well, actually, I think it was, no, she was a leading student, Jung's first student in Switzerland, or first a patient then a student, and she was actually Dulles' secretary in Switzerland during the OSS days. Anne Bancroft has written a book for an autobiography of a spy. Put out by Morrow or somebody that I haven't actually read, but she's an interesting character. Anyway, so that's all in perspective here. Now, there was always something that puzzled me about the LSD story that I kind of was suspicious of in the beginning, and that was the strange gap in time, which might not be strange at all. In fact, probably isn't, but from 1938 to 43, 38 when it's first synthesized.
Oh, you mean Hoffman's...
Hoffman synthesized it in 1938, and he says it went on the shelf and it sat there until 1943.
Right.
And then he had he discovered its effects. And,
his story on it, I'm sure you've heard. Right?
Well, that's basically his story. Right. There doesn't seem to be too much to it. Now, what's interesting about that is that during the time when he made that invention and that discovery, Sandoz was linked through cartel agreements to IG Farben Chemical Company, was the largest chemical company in the world and was really the backbone of the whole Nazi Third Reich war effort, IG Farben. IG Farben had extensive links to American corporations, both drug corporations, pharmaceutical corporations, and oil corporations. And the link, the legal aspect of that link, was represented by Sullivan Cromwell, which was the law firm for which Alice Dulles worked. Dulles, in this effect, was in Switzerland, not only as a spy, but also one who, as a businessman, was still continuing those links through secret negotiations with the Nazis between the U.S. and German corporations, which was all legal and hush-hush during the war. So that's one reason why he's there. There's no doubt about that. So the cartel agreements, since IG Farben was so dominant in the war, they gobbled up everybody, and Sandoz was just a sitting duck there. Generally speaking, the way it would be is that IG Farben would enter into these agreements whereby they would have automatically the patent rights to any new invention or discovery made by corporations that were, you know, sort of gobbled up by them and through these cartel links. Therefore, should that apply to Sandoz, as I have every reason to believe, given the fact the way I've studied the way R.G. Farben operated, it would mean that at the time Hoffman invented and discovered LSD, that RG, technically speaking, that would have been the property of R.G. Farben, this incredible thing, you know, and this monster corporation was running some of the concentration camps, slave labor at Auschwitz for R.G. Farben, all this stuff. Bad news business. But what if Hoffman knew really all along what it was?
Or somebody else somehow.
Or somebody else did, or whatever. The fact of the matter is, I'm gonna put this in context here. Yeah. I don't believe that he's lying, but I'm just saying that the way I was thinking about it at one point was, well, dude, this is curious. You have these dates. This could have been, certainly been an accident, as you said. But on the other hand, at the time that defects were discovered in 43, even then, it should have, technically speaking, through the patent agreements, gone to I.G. Farben. At a time when they were testing mescaline at Dachau, right? So they'd be very interested in this. They're already aware of these substances, right? I mean, a high Nazi command, they don't just go testing something at Dachau. It means they're very high up in the hierarchy, they're knowing about this, and they're saying, do it. The patent form is only filed in 46, 3 years after. Okay, again, the war is over. I mean, that might be 44, I'm not sure, but whatever it is, it's at a time when clearly the Third Reich is going to collapse, or it might be just after its collapse. So that certainly gets around this snag of the whatever. Imagine if the Nazis had LSD. Yeah. No, I mean,
that's interesting. Yeah.
So maybe it was withheld because of these secret political, or because of these political things. Now, that's one story. The other story is that according to Captain Al Hubbard, and I didn't put this in my book, he says Hoffman did not discover it in 1938, not discover it in 1943, much earlier, that he was with a small group of people.
Hoffman.
This is according to Captain Al Hubbard here. This is what he knew, you know, but he also is an exaggerator and, you know, this kind of thing. But that there's a small group of people who are nominally connected with Steiner's group, the anthroposophy, whatever they're in Switzerland, or Austria, I can't remember where it was, in their early 30s, that they cautiously decided they set out to make a peace bill to help mankind. Because they saw, you know, the beginnings of the Nazi emergence, we're all concerned about this. So they consciously set out to make something like LSD, which they did, and they kept secret from the world until the right moment. That's his story. Now, there's absolutely no evidence to confirm that. And Hoffman denies it. You know, I didn't ask him, but he certainly has never acknowledged anything like that. And Hubbard is an aggrandizer. He likes to be the one who knows, or the one who has the LSD, and that's his character. But it's a curious story. And just because I wouldn't completely discount it, I mean, Hubbard knows a lot of things. The basic outline of the story that he told, just what I hear, turning on, I believe, gives me. I mean, basic outlines of it are correct. Some details might be exaggerated. But that particular tale, I can never confirm. And I might have put it as a footnote in the book, but it just seemed, you know, there's a lot of things that didn't make it in the book, things I could have put in, you know, that, you know, that just for one reason or another, either throughout, I was exhausted at the end, I was trying to finish it or whatever, it didn't get in there. But there is that story. And for somehow or another, I felt like when I heard Hubbard describing this, it wasn't the first time I had heard that story or heard such suspicions there, but indeed it was connected to this conscious, it was, like, must have been like a secret society thing. Steiner, or secret wisdom, or whatever. But like I said,
so alchemy, you know, being able to combat that.
Exactly, along those lines.
How does it work?
But let me stress really strongly, you have to put this in here, that I don't subscribe to that theory.
Yeah.
And that I don't have any reason to doubt Hoffman.
Uh-huh.
I would like to meet, I did meet him, but I didn't really talk to him a great many. Maybe if I get to Europe, I'll go visit him and ask him. I know he's a fan. I really like the guy. I think we're really lucky that he discovered
all this. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Really
lucky.
And he, I think, is one of the best advertisements for the, you know, for LSD there is, not in terms of advertising how to sell this product, but just as to, you know, what this product is all about. He's a great guy. Such a vitality and enthusiasm for life for coming out of his. That's a curious thing. Funny you should mention it. But in terms of, well, you know, the CIA is a secret society. In the CIA, there's all kinds of secret societies operating. There's a lot of Freemasons in the CIA, and the Knights of Malta, very strong in the CIA. And there's other groups, yeah.
And it might be that these different secret societies, which over, you know, I mean, it's not that they're nice and more than just in the CIA, there's nice and more than the corporate world and whatever, and there's Freemasonic groups, you know, some of them in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, some of them in the FBI, some of them in the CIA, some of them in the Defense Department, some of them in the industry, you know. But maybe these different clubs and groups would help, if we understood them, the secret society would help delineate different factions within the power elite. It might be that they join this group because that identifies them in such a way as different from another group. Or maybe some group will lie, other groups aren't. Maybe these different groups represent different political positions.
Fact of the ruling class.
Yeah, it might be.
You think these are just that, you know, I mean, you go to any large group of people and there's going to be rotaries and lions, and or do you think these are like well-defined cliques?
I think that
coordinate between the Masons and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Masons and the CIA and the Masons on Wall Street or whatever.
I think it works on two levels. I think for the proletariat, you know, for the rest of us, it's just the Rotary Club scene where Masonry doesn't really mean anything other than, you know, a way to get away from your wife on a Monday night, or a way to get away from your, you know, it doesn't really have much of a meaning in that way. But on the very highest levels, you know, Masonry, you go through all those initiation rites. When you get to that highest level, 32nd, 33rd degree Freemason, then you're dealing with very influential, powerful individuals. And at that level, maybe these different groups can shed some, studying these different groups can shed some light on understanding different factions within the ruling elite, links between Europe and the U.S., you know, certain factional and ideological link-ups.
Yeah, everything. Harry Truman said that I think the quote is, I've got about every damn degree they give out, and I don't know any secrets. Do you think he was just using the word secrets differently, or do you think he was actively hiding something, or do you think he was in the wrong faction, or how would you reconcile that statement with what you just said?
I think the politicians are the front men, and nobody ever tells them.
Well, yeah, they're part of the club, but they're the little guys, you know, and certainly. Well, I think there's two things. I mean, it's a good question. I don't think that these groups represent vital mystical bodies or traditions. I think that they're sort of decrepit, a bit like what organized religion is to mysticism. You know, they don't represent, you know, a real mystical currents anymore.
Yeah. Just cliques within the power of the
kind of fossilized structures. I mean, Masonry does have some kind of mystical esoteric roots because they're going way back.
What I have to imagine is that if these people had any sense of having some kind of occult underpinnings to their power, and suddenly they're dosed with LSD, they must have thought, my God, you know, this is it, we've got it now. So that might have played a part in their enthusiasm for it.
Well, now, there is information to the effect that Alan Dulles is a Freemason. And there's a source in France who says that, a French journalist. I haven't seen that in other places, I don't know if it's true. But I do know for sure he was a member of certain chivalric groups and secret societies in Europe. I know that for a fact. And a lot of other people in the CIA were associated with Knights Templar, Knights of Malta, like really strange groups. And again, at this point, it doesn't really have anything to do with the original mystical use. So in that sense, they're not like learning mystical secrets which they're not supposed to divulge. So, you know, he wouldn't have anything to hide in that way. But it's more like the secrets of the kind of machinations of the power elite. I think that they're dealing with that at that level. And obviously Truman is not going to announce to the world, for example, that his top intelligence agency is involved with the most potent mind known to man, LSD. And that's a secret that he's not going to divulge. He'll know about it probably, you know, because it was that kind of drug where it was that important that probably in some memo the president was informed that indeed.
Major weapon.
Indeed, we have something cooking here.
Right, well, somebody had to approve the funding for it.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. But, you know, things are bureaucratically structured so that there's a plausible deniability, so the president doesn't have... It would appear that the president doesn't really know. Maybe something they actually don't know. But... So, it's a mixed bag. I think that there's certainly... When you get that levels of power, you know plenty of secrets. Maybe they don't have to do with the secrets of the mystical roots of Masonry, but certainly Masons aren't supposed to reveal the rituals they go through on each degree. They're not supposed to. I know what some of them are. They lie in coffins with bandanas around their eyes with pictures of severed limbs and heads dripping blood.
But somehow they get out in various forms, right?
that's, you know, make, you can imagine the president lying in a coffin with him. Gerald Ford used to have what they call raisings at the White House when they were president. So this is a strange stuff going on here. I think mainly it's male bonding and stuff, probably. But I'm interested in these things. One can make a lot of it, but who knows?
You know, it's, Dr. Shulgin is a member of the Bohemian Club.
Yes, I do. Although he asked me, and I respect him, is he asked me never to print his name in any of my work, which I've not done.
There wasn't any mention of him at the end when you mentioned new psychedelics and stuff like that.
I refer to all this stuff. I don't have that from him. I've talked to him numerous times. I like him a lot.
Yeah, but I guess we should make this off.
Yeah.
Not
so, yeah, I
know him and I like him a lot too. But,
yeah. Well, I know that he has some. He has.
He did work with Edward Arsenal, like, originally.
Edward Arsenal? Did he work with Dow Chemical?
He says that he just contracted.
Yeah, that he contracted. I don't think that Shulgin's ever lied to me, but I don't think that he's told me everything. I don't care. I think Shulgin's a good guy, a decent guy.
My sense.
He's in a very unique position, and he's really, as you well know, he's at the edge.
He asked us not to mention print either, but we already have some.
No, I didn't have any need to, really. Yeah. But he was very helpful to me in identifying. Yeah. He was my chemical advisor. Like, I would ask him, what's this guy? You know, I would get funny long names that would, like, fill a half a page. Yeah. You know, with one.
What is this stuff?
I would say, oh, that's MDA. They killed a man with that. You know, that's how we discovered that the Army, the drug they used in their experiment that killed that guy, Harold Lauer, at 52, was MDA. So Shulgin identified that. Before, it had always been referred to as a mescaline analog, which is a poor description of MDA. You know, it's not really, I mean, it's stretching. Yeah, I know he's got some connections, but this world is full of strange points and answers and contradictions.
Did you find
your gut level?
Did you find yourself becoming more flexible in terms of your judgments of other these kinds of things? I mean, being able to look at Al Hubbard, who the hell is this guy? And then say, yeah, but he's
an
incredible guy.
I mean, I felt good about it. Stark, I was Stark's people.
Yeah, but did you meet him, or he died before your book was written, or?
He died as it was being finished. You know, everything's a mixed bag. Society's full of contradictions. So no one's going to be totally pure, and no one's going to be totally evil either, probably.
Now watch out where you say things like that in this country these days.
No, you know, realistically, I mean, it's a... CIA is almost like a deceptive term. Within the CIA, there's so many different factions. There's so much disagreement. And there's, you know, there's a more liberal wing, there's a more conservative wing. And, you know, it's a very...
that's fallacious to think of it monolithically.
Yeah, it's not a monolithic organization, although, you know, its function, its position within the power structure, it's performing a very evil function.
Maybe I've already asked this. I would get off the
dishonor.
Yeah, back on again. To get off the secret society thing in a minute. But just, did you run into any evidence that at this point or during the 60s and the 70s that possibly a group within the CIA became attached to LSD in a mystical way and might be operating as a sort of psychedelic CIA, which is something that I theorized about it. This guy might be a CIA, you know, that we run into so many different people. Well, if they are, they seem to be doing it for the right reasons.
Well, if you mean that people actually within the CIA and working with the LSD and the drugs, not some of the CIA will contract once in a while or, you know, on the periphery, but the actual CIA agents, of which I don't think Lyle Stark is one of them. I think he's more on the periphery. But not exactly. I mean, there were some CIA agents who, after they left the agency or, you know, they got into things that would be somewhat atypical for a CIA agent. One person got into, he's in meditation structure, Eastern mystical type of meditation structure. I wouldn't say his name, but, so, I mean, how he got to that point from the CIA, that's interesting. Maybe LSD. In fact, from his way of, his evolution, his personal evolution, I wouldn't doubt it. I'd be sort of surprised if it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where he ended up. And none of his got into humanistic psychology and so forth, which is a more flexible, open-minded type of psychology, more in line with psychedelics and psychokinetic. But whether there was a clique within the CIA,
no,
my hunch is probably not in any strictly defined sense. Probably not.
There's been a lot of controversy around the SRI and Willis Farnham. You seem to imply in the book that is he hardcore CIA, or Leary has told a few people that he thought Willis Farnham was CIA?
Did you ever talk to Michael Rossman about Willis Harmon?
No.
Did you ask him about Willis Harmon?
Yeah.
I'll tell you some of the Willis Harmon stories. Harmon is a big wig at Stanford Research Institute. And someone who once worked at the SRI under him, I don't think you could publish this, it would be libelous.
Yeah.
But claimed, off the record, claimed he had... but he claimed that Harmon accepted a contract to do a study for the CIA on some kind of futures thing. When everyone else in the futures department had overruled him and said, don't do it, Harmon went ahead and did it. Which, if it's true, and I don't know if it is, I heard it from one guy who is not the most reliable source, would suggest that he's got some kind of, as a contract employee, he's one of those peripheral agents. But, like I said, I never pursued it.
So
it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Like that.
He's not a CIA agent per se, but he might be a security critic because he was working with Uri Geller at a time when Uri Geller was being tested by the CIA. You know, the SRI think tank world overlaps with the SRI itself. Did a lot of they did BZ experiment. They were very much part of the chemical warfare program in the Army. Doing contract studies for the Army, also done work in parapsychology and ESP, and that was all in the rubric of mind control initially for the CIA. So there are connections there, but you can't print a harm in the CIA, a harm in the CIA, because you're not trying.
No.
I had that initially in the book, and the lawyers cut it out. That's just one of the things. Now, he's someone I'm very suspicious of. I wish people in the New Age movement or human potential movement would realize that,
there are a lot of people who just say SRI, CIA, Will Harmon, SRI.
I think Harmon is too well respected in this movement. I would stay away from that guy. But I think he's too well respected still. Mark Satin, you know that guy?
He's a journal,
but some kind of New Age philosophy book. He has this newsletter in Washington now called New Options. He's really a little gaga about Willis Harmon, Mark Satin, that's actually pretty good. He's trying to do like a human potential type of politics. I think one should be very wary of Willis Harmon. You can't somehow get in the last round. I just say that, there are funny connections about the guy. I punch him out in the book. If people read between the lines, they realize something funny's going on. But ask Glassman about the Willis Harmon story. He has a few of them that are interesting.
You mentioned DZ, a total leap in another direction. You know anybody who experienced
DZ?
There were like
2,800 soldiers.
Yeah. Because actually, I'm saying, we're talking about all kinds of things I'm not going to be able to print, because I promised I would never print this also. Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, you know who they are? They're the life extension.
Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, yeah.
They're unusual characters. They were telling us that this is the most extraordinary psychedelic and that they did it and that it's not pleasant, but that you come away with all your neuroses pretty much eliminated. Looking at them, I wouldn't. I don't know what I would make of it.
I don't think any neuroses are eliminated by any drug, but the psychedelic drugs make it possible to confront neurotic situations in such a way that one might be able to work through them. So that those drugs, ecstasy, LSD, can help, possibly, but not by any absolute definition. It would mean automatically a person would be able to deal well with the stuff that comes up. Some people might be too much, they might be very, And still, a person has to have this, the wherewithal to deal with that. Now, as we all know, these drugs that act in such a way that seems to help people deal with that, which is great, and it's too bad that, you know, you can't do more of this in scientific studies with that. But BZ,
never heard any good reports on that.
No, I never did. Not from the arm. I never heard it.
And they did, they spread that on the Ed Pong.
That didn't happen. I think I know about six or seven different. It was something called Operation White Wing. I think I might have mentioned in the book.
Has there been any other use of that repudiated in the term of chemical warfare?
There was some discussion of using it or supplying the... Remember there was that rescue mission in Iran to get the hostages? The team that never got there was equipped with an incapacitating agent. And there's only one standard incapacitating agent in the Army's arsenal. And that's BZ. So it means they were equipped with BZ. So maybe that was their plan. You know, maybe that was the third option if the two first ones failed. I don't know. But that's one situation. And then they do have, they have it stockpiled. And there are documents that refer to use, recommend using it as a domestic crowd control agent.
In terms of chemical warfare, I wonder, like some of the new heroin analogs, if you know, the government, the Army, CIA might not be behind that, but yeah, they'd be incredibly
very
small
strong,
amount
right?
of
very strong.
Fentanyl is enough to put the whole city under.
Well, here's a scenario. It might have been that the CIA and the Army initially contracted to develop those analogs. They wouldn't have developed them themselves. They're not real scientists, but they have to, generally, for the real hardcore work, they got to go to outside experts to do that. They might have spurred some of that research. They might have sponsored it. They might have hooked into it when it was happening and helped it along in some way, shape, or form, and to see if it would be a good as an incapacitating agent or what. I mean, heroin was looked at as an incapacitating agent. Marijuana was looked at. The incapacitating agents that were on, they had like about 65 of them that made it through the final screen, up until the final screening. Very interesting drugs. Prolixin. Did I mention this at the
moment? I don't think so.
Prolixin, you know, the mental insufficiency is a really bad drug, very terrible side effects. It makes people twitch funny. Ritalin is used widely on hyperactive children, which is considered a candidate incapacitating agent of the Army.
Really?
DMT, STP, a whole bunch of BZ analogs, Compazine,
How would they propose to, spread them around?
Well, again, this is the screening process.
An aerosol,
they have thousands and thousands of different drugs.
They play around with it.
And it goes through this rigorous screening process. And then they get the final, the ones who make it to the beauty contest. You know, 65 or so that are listed as of 1975. They were looking at still testing it for incapacitating properties if they could develop something even better than BZ. And I just mentioned that those are some of the drugs that made it to that point. I don't know what happened after that. And I don't know that they had any intention of spreading it around other than to use it in, you know, specific types of warfare or counterinsurgency situations. Now, I have no evidence that they ever wanted to see it spread around. Might have been, but that's not the kind of thing you'd expect to find in CIA documents anyway. They wouldn't put that. I don't personally believe that, that the CIA dumped all this stuff on the black market. I think it's a more subtle thing. Now, it might have been, but I never found the evidence. And I just think that's just a there's far out things in the story of the past. It's just too far out for me. You know, but maybe that's my own prejudice because I'm identified with certain types of attitude toward LSD that makes it hard for me to really believe in my gut that they would go and force this thing on people when, you know,
is there like
such a mixed benefit? I just couldn't.
Right. The thing is, no matter what is happening out there subjectively or objectively in the political world, it still doesn't take away your subjective experience.
Yeah. And no matter how weird things got at the end of the 60s and early 70s in terms of the movement having so many problems and being factionalized and split and there being tensions between political and cultural factions and all that, and things turning violent and whether underground and all that shitty stuff, Alkaline, again and again, borrowing and heroin coming in. Yeah, that's a sad story at the end here, and things flat very quickly. But that's not to say that somebody in 1971 would take LSD and not have a profound, exciting, empowering experience. Just because everything else is fucking up doesn't mean that people aren't having that happened. At the same token, it's the other way around too. But what my point was that what's happening in the culture is going to affect the kind of experience, it's going to affect the person's psyche. And it's going to therefore affect what comes out during an LSD trip. It's not simple.
You're aware of...